Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, we dig into changes lawmakers want to make to high-speed rail. With the route limited to the San Joaquin Valley, will resources get diverted to the Bay Area and Southern California cities instead? I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. 9 months after the most destructive wildfire in the state's history destroyed the town of Paradise, we talked to an investigative reporter about the forces that came together to cause such a deadly blaze.
But first, a recap of this week's news. The U.S. Navy confirmed Thursday that a pilot died during a routine training flight from Lemoore Naval Air Station through Death Valley National Park. The FA-18E Super Hornet went down Wednesday morning when it crashed in a rugged area near Crawley Point. The pilot's identity has not yet been released. The park confirmed that several visitors had non-life-threatening wounds from the crash as well.
In Kern County, a body found in an SUV that was pulled out of the Kern River has been identified as former McFarland city manager John Wooner, according to the Kern County Coroner's report. California Highway Patrol officer Robert Rodriguez said the 57-year-old had been missing since May 14th.
We are still in the process of investigating the reason why he went into over the side and into the river.
The car was found off of Highway 178 just outside of Bakersfield. The coroner's report says Wooner died at the scene, but an autopsy will be performed to determine the cause of death.
And coming up on Monday, the Delano City Council will vote on whether to become a sanctuary city. The resolution would limit the city's involvement with immigration and customs enforcement. If passed, Delano would join Livingston as one of two sanctuary cities in the San Joaquin Valley. Selma, meanwhile, calls itself a welcoming city. Here's Valerie Grosby from the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment.
That would send a clear message to our kids and to our families that you're not just protected at school, but you are protected after school, on your way home from school, when you go out grocery shopping with your family, when you go get school supplies with your family and you're shopping at local businesses.
Californians are going to experience hotter and hotter temperatures in coming decades. Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero has more on a report from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Imagine Sacramento with more than 2 months of over 100-degree weather a year and a month of 105-degree temperatures. That could be a reality in just half a century unless action is taken to reduce global warming. The report Killer Heat in the United States finds that by 2070, places like Sacramento could experience 6 days of off-the-chart heat every year. That means days at or above 127 degrees. They say extreme heat is inevitable, even in the best-case scenario where greenhouse gas emissions are significantly reduced. The authors say the solution isn't just about reducing emissions, it's about preparing for the effects extreme heat has on people.
And today, healthcare workers with Kaiser Permanente in Fresno will be among the 80,000 union members who will vote on whether to authorize a national strike. The last contract expired in late 2018. If approved, the strike would take place in October.
Listen for more FM 89 news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. There are 250 AM radio stations in California, each a window into a different cultural community. In Fresno, a station called KBIF has changed along with the San Joaquin Valley. As part of the California Dream collaboration, Capital Public Radio's Julia Mitrich visited the station and brings us this story.
Music.
In 1954, when KBIF went on the air, it was a big band station. But evangelical radio was on the rise, and by the early 60s, the format changed.
We used to be a real hot area for tent revivals.
Tony Donato is KBIF's general manager. He started working here in high school, 1979. He says back then, pastors from the Bible Belt hosted live radio shows.
And they would have a tent revival over on Dakota and Hughes Avenue, come this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for our tent revival and get healed.
In the 80s and 90s, immigration was changing the Central Valley. Fresno became home to Hmong refugees fleeing Laos and Vietnam, and Punjabi immigrants from India. So, in the late 80s, KBIF added Punjabi music, religious programs, and local talk shows. That's Gurdeep Shergill. He's had a weekend show for 16 years. He and his family came to Fresno from the Punjab region of India during a large migration that began in the 90s. He was 14.
The Punjabi American community in the Fresno County area, they were kind of lost. I felt I was lost. So that was my approach. I was like, you know, we need to do something about it. What's better than media, better than a radio?
Shergill plays Punjabi hip-hop. He also talks about issues he thinks matter to the local Punjabi community. Water security, immigration, hate crimes. He says Punjabi truckers are some of his bedrock supporters.
Like about 2 weeks ago, one of the truckers, he was driving. When my show was on, he parked his truck. And he said, I'm going to listen to the whole thing before I go on.
Growing up, as soon as, you know, the weekend hit, like, our radio dial went to AM 900.
That's Nandeep Singh, a community organizer in Fresno. We meet at a restaurant. Singh calls the station part town hall, part bazaar. You might catch health tips on avoiding hypertension. A few minutes later,
people are talking politics in the corner. People are just trying to find out the latest music on the side. People are talking about what's happening in the trucking industry. And you will run through the litany of that on any given Saturday.
But on weekdays, the station broadcasts talk shows, music, and ads in Hmong. Michael Yang hosts a weekly show with farming advice for about 1,000 Hmong farmers who call Fresno home. He's been doing it for 20 years. He lists market prices for Asian specialty vegetables like
bitter melons, bok choy, daikon, and long beans, so on.
Yang says getting this price check helps Hmong farmers avoid getting cheated by buyers. During the call-in segment of the show, Yang takes questions from folks listening in their pickups and in the fields. They ask,
you know, oh, I have these bugs that are eating my crops. And I don't know what chemical to use. Can you come in and look at it?
And he does. Looking ahead, one challenge for KBIF, for both the Hmong and Punjabi shows, is how to get and keep younger listeners. Many are bilingual, and there's tons of other media out there for them. So I asked Saturday host Gurdeep Shergill, any interest in podcasting?
You know, actually, personally for me, I like it live. Like, I want to be natural. Like, I want people to see if I have to even do, you know, it's okay because I'm a human, okay?
And that's what KBF tries to do, reflect the humanness of this stretch of the Central Valley and all the ways it continues to change. In Fresno, I'm Julia Mitrich.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. With the wildfire season upon us, we're going to take a look back at last year's campfire, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California's history. It decimated the town of Paradise, destroyed 19,000 structures, and took the lives of 85 people. In its aftermath, writer and journalist Mark Arak spent months digging into the reasons for such a deadly blaze. I spoke with him about his investigative piece called Gone, which is out this week in the California Sunday Magazine. So you start the story with a tour of Paradise 4 months after the fire, and your guide is a young mother and resident who takes you to the spot where the home she grew up in once stood, and it was a home like thousands of other structures that had been demolished by the fire. And you ask her this question that becomes kind of the basis for your article. Did fire come to Paradise or did Paradise come to the fire? And what you find is kind of a perfect storm of greed, corruption, bad forestry policies, free-for-all development that sets up paradise for this unbelievable disaster. So let's start with the town. By the 70s, there were scores of housing tracts without sidewalks or gutters or buffers to provide a space against fire. A municipal sewage system was never constructed, and essentially it was a city with no governance.
Yeah, I thought when I asked her that question, did fire come to paradise or did paradise go to fire, it was kind of an unfair question to ask her. That's why I was there. And so almost as soon as I asked her the question, I kind of brushed it away. But that's the question that kind of defines the piece. This is a gold rush town. So it started off in that supercharged way. And then when gold left the mountain, lumber became the new gold, and then agriculture, and then suburbia. You know, when I went up there, I thought, okay, we're going to have one of these mountain villages that we see, like Shaver or something, right? Shaver's gotten big itself. But this was a whole sprawling suburbia. And they called it the town of paradise. The town with the future was the slogan. But it was really a whole city, almost like it had been taken and lifted the model from Los Angeles or something. 40,000 people were living on this ridge, and it had grown in the most untrammeled way. And I found these women. Well, one named Pam Figge, who started off as a reporter, then became a town planner, and then became a professor at Chico State, which is 15 miles down the ridge. And another one named Jane Dolan, who kind of recreated the atmosphere of growth that happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s there. Figge remembers a process called 4x4ing. I'd never heard that term. But basically, you know, you have this influential businessman in paradise. It could be anybody. And he buys a parcel, and the supervisors, because back then the board of supervisors made all the land use decisions in paradise. And they agree to his request to divide the parcel into four pieces. Then he sells one of those four pieces to a friend or a family member or a partner. And then that person goes before the same board and wins approval to divide his piece into four. So on and on, you have this four, four, four slicing and dicing. Why the number four? It wasn't arbitrary. You know, had they split it into five, they would have had to follow state law, subdivision law. And the developers would have had to pay for proper infrastructure.
And you do mention some whistleblowers. In 1998, there was one spunky couple who sued Paradise for its refusal to require sewers and roads to escape fire. The town was forced to hire planners and follow zoning codes, but it was essentially too late.
It was too late. There were 30,000 people by that time living in the suburban equivalent of a tinderbox.
On top of development, there's also these huge forestry issues. You've got this really interesting source, Richard Wilson, who ran the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection in the 1990s. And he talks about how the forests essentially weren't managed.
So he gave me an education. I mean, he said that he didn't think we could have managed the forests any worse. So, you know, he started with the Indians, who gave us this natural forest. And it was patchy. You know, that's the thing. When you look at old photos, you see that the forest back in the 1840s was patchy. And these trees grew to differing heights, and that was a healthy forest. You know, the wall-to-wall trees that we look at, kind of a form of agriculture on the mountain.
It's not natural.
That's not natural. It's not healthy. And so the combination of open ground and this uneven canopy back in pre-settlement days kept the fires from raging, and the fires were natural. And when they burned, by lightning strike usually was the spark, they kind of burned themselves out. They scorched the forest floor. They thinned out the lower branches and shrubs. That allowed the taming of the next fire, but it also allowed these new trees to generate. Instead, the timber companies then come in, and they don't work inside those natural cycles. They're pumping out wood. They're pumping out trees, and they're planting one tree on top of the other. And Richard Wilson said that this was this uniform growth. When fire hit it, it becomes a blowtorch. The trees are nothing but matchsticks.
So we've got untrammeled development, we've got unmanaged forest, and then I also noticed one of the more interesting twists in the story is the evolution of CAL FIRE. almost at the expense of forest rangers, because the services that the forest rangers were performing, such as reducing fuel loads in mountain communities, were curtailed and ranger numbers dwindled, firefighters increased. The department existed almost as a partner with towns such as Paradise.
That's right. So you've got these factors. You've got the untrammeled growth. You've got the kindling of the human settlement and now the kindling of the mismanaged forest. And then on top of that, you have CAL FIRE changing its role, its purpose. It's very uniform. It went from khaki, the khaki of the ranger, to the blue of the firefighter. And that wasn't just a change in uniform. That was a change in mission. The ranger found himself a second-class citizen in a department he once commanded. So the services he performed, you know, which were coordinating prescribed burns, protecting watersheds from the rack of clear cuts, reducing those fuel loads in the mountain communities, those were all curtailed. And what took place instead was this structuring of California firefighting into what is a disaster industrial complex. Now, fighting fire is like this warlike mobilization that requires helicopters and air tankers and, you know, these machines that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And that becomes its own kind of reality.
So, in other words, the department is existing because there are towns like Paradise.
The state of California and all its agencies, including CAL FIRE, they never tell these communities, hey, the growth that you're bringing to this mountain, it's dangerous, it's courting disaster. Instead, CAL FIRE ends up serving that growth. It becomes the fire department of the mountain communities. And this is what Richard Wilson bemoans, because not only did they keep quiet, they ended up profiting off that footprint expanding more and more into the wildland-urban interface. I mean, the numbers of Californians in the wildland-urban interface, I mean, it's grown extraordinarily. I mean, in the last, we have 10 million Californians, a quarter of our population living in the path of wildfire, and it keeps getting, you know, growing every decade.
And you brought up Richard Wilson again. Another thing that he found was that there was this linear pattern of ignition clusters that corresponded to major electrical power lines. So that brings us to another element in this perfect storm, which is PG&E.
We have the mismanagement of growth, the mismanagement of the forest. That's the kindling. And then we have the spark. And the spark turns out to be PG&E. And I go back with the help of legal documents and find how PG&E has this culture of corruption and malfeasance, and it goes back decades. And when I talk to some of the lawyers who are representing some of the victims of the 2017-2018 fires, they say that the DNA for this kind of culture shift inside PG&E that they really saw it play out in 2010 in San Bruno, when a gas line blew up a suburban community, destroyed, I think, 36 homes, and killed 8 people. Its malfeasance and negligence in that was, well, it was found to be criminal. And that tragedy did not change the way PG&E did business. And so what happened in that suburban community then ends up happening in the forest.
And so what role exactly did PG&E play in the Paradise Fire?
PG&E has quite a chore. I mean, they're the biggest utility in the country, and they're having to deliver power to all these growing communities. And they're freighting this power across great swaths of forest land. It's not an easy job. But they've been very negligent in taking out the trees, and also they've been poor at replacing aged kind of infrastructure. And so there was a tower that was so old that it let go of this piece of equipment. It just fell in the high winds, and that's what set the fire that day.
So it was a live wire.
It was a live wire that was, it broke free of its clasp from this metal tower 100 feet tall.
And PG&E also didn't shut the power off that day, even though they knew there was going to be low humidity and high winds.
perfect wildfire conditions. They even called all the folks in Butte, you know, all the people in the Ridge community, sent out text messages and everything saying that be prepared, we're going to turn off the power. And for some reason, they didn't.
Do other power companies in the state of California do things differently?
It's a great question. They do. If you compare the statistics, you'll find that PG&E sets a lot more fires than Southern California Edison or San Diego Pacific Gas and Electric. Those other two utilities learned some real lessons out of the wildfires of the early 2000s. And they put in weather stations. They were able to monitor things. They had a policy of turning off the electricity in high winds. PG&E never adopted those changes or were slow to adopt them. They're only doing that now.
And this goes way back. You mentioned the Rough and Ready fire in Nevada County in 1994 that apparently was caused by PG&E's failure to prune back vegetation surrounding its power lines, and it destroyed 12 homes and a historic schoolhouse. But what you mentioned in the article that really shocked me was even back then, the utility had diverted $495 million from its tree trimming budget to increase corporate payoffs.
Time and again, PG&E took money that should have gone to safety and ended up putting it in the pockets of their executives and their shareholders. And in a courtroom in San Francisco, a federal judge who was weighing whether or not PG&E needs to have even more constraints put upon it after being found a felon, a corporate felon, he has been challenging them. This guy named Alsup, Judge Alsup, a Mississippian, 73-year-old guy who's rapping their knuckles every time they appear, and you know, he keeps underscoring this point that money that should have gone to safety went into executive and shareholder profits.
So how does a company get away with that?
That is the question. It gets away with it because we have a watchdog, the California Public Utilities Commission, that isn't a watchdog. The relationship over the years, and that is something that I really examine in this piece, the relationship between PG&E and the CPUC, the California Public Utilities, it's really close. And in fact, they write letters for each other. And so we don't have a watchdog, and PG&E exerts such power, you know, they can get away with it. I mean, the judge essentially said they got away with murder.
So one last question. You had mentioned earlier that our state's population is exploding in some of the most susceptible areas to fires. And that's kind of the question at the heart of your book, The Dreamt Land, which is, you know, what's going to give? How much more can we grow in this state? Any answers on that?
Yeah, the book and this piece are all about the system that we built, this magnificent system, and it's cracking. And will it see us into a future of more houses in the farm belt, more houses across the desert, more houses in the wildland urban interface, more almond trees? I don't know. We don't seem to be willing to ask ourselves that question, which to me is the question that we should begin with. How big can we get? Where, you know, we're talking now about building 1 million and if not more affordable houses. Into what safe zone are we going to build these houses? It's weird that the gold rush happened a long time ago, but its mentality is with us. That supercharged way we began, we seem to think that we can continue to outrace our nature. And now our nature is linking up to global climate change. I'm not sure we can outrun that.
And when you have 85 people dying in a situation like this that probably could have been prevented, it makes the question even more important.
It does, and that's the question I leave there with. As some of the people that I've spent months with, they're going back and they're planning to rebuild right there again. And they explain to you in a way that makes sense on an emotional level why they want to do that. This is their home. And then you drive down that ridge and you go past the city of Sacramento. And if you know a little California history, you know that John Sutter basically founded our state capital right where two mighty rivers meet, you know, the worst floodplain in all of California. So there's our original sin.
Again, we've been talking to writer Mark Arax about his recent piece, Gone, in the California Sunday Magazine about the town of Paradise. He's also the author of the recent book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Alice.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Now we move to Bakersfield, where police believe the unsolved cases of three young people who are either missing or dead are connected. In the spring of 2018, James Colstead was killed in a drive-by shooting within weeks of the disappearance of Bailey Despot and Micah Holsenbake. While the search for Bailey continues, Micah is now presumed dead after his arm was discovered in the Kern River. In the months following, the mothers of the victims joined forces to find justice for their adult children, now known as the Bakersfield Three. The mission is to fund public safety in Kern County, potentially by pushing for a sales tax on the ballot. Moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with Cheryl Holsenbake, mother of Micah.
Cheryl, I want to start out by just expressing my condolences for the loss that your family has endured. It's unimaginable.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. It's been a long, almost year and a half, about year and a half, and it's been hard.
Yeah. Can you explain the connection between your son and the other two victims and then how you came to work with the other two mothers, Diane Byrne and Jane Parent?
Yes, we, near the beginning of last year, toward the end of March, our son, our adult son, went missing. And we spent about a year looking for him and calling friends and trying to find information. And one day I got a phone call, and it was from Diane. And she said, and by that time I had heard that James, her son, had been killed. And she said, did you know that our sons were kind of hanging out and spending time together? And I said, no. And we began looking at friend lists on Facebook and noticing that they had many, many friends in common. Not very long, maybe 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks after that, Bailey Despot, who is Jane's daughter, went missing. And we saw that on Facebook as well. And we recognized that name because we had heard that name early on in connection to Micah. And he actually knew her and her sister from a while back. And so we just happened to be three families that were connected through really horrible circumstances. And then Micah, of course, was identified, one of the human remains that was found in the Kern River late last summer was identified via DNA as being related to me, which of course identified that as Micah's. And then, but we've not found any evidence of Bailey at this point. So
again, I'm just so sorry.
Thank you.
You know, at a time when it would have been perfectly understandable for you and the other two mothers to be singularly focused on finding justice for your children, you also, in addition to that work, were advocating on a number of issues, including lobbying the Board of Supervisors to dedicate $30,000 to establish a secret witness program in Kern County. What drove you to take on these larger issues?
Well, early on, all three of us had issues with the system, to put it bluntly. Things that were not working, things we felt were a kind of what you would not expect an agency or agencies to do while they were trying to be helpful to families. And so we found out early on that there was a tiny bit of money available for secret witness. So we thought, well, we can try and fix that. So we went to the Board of Supervisors and we asked them for money, and they gave us discretionary funds and they revamped their secret witness program. And we've you know, we've been really compelled to try and raise some money for search and rescue, because at least for Jane and I, that has been really close to our heart, because search and rescue has been involved in looking for our children. And so those kinds of things, you know, we felt things weren't working properly. And so we thought, well, while we're waiting for justice, we might as well be busy doing something else that will make some of this have a little bit of meaning at the end. And so that's what we've been doing ever since.
And now, of course, one of your focus areas is on potentially securing better funding for law enforcement in Kern County. Tell us about what is going on about a potential sales tax increase.
Well, one of the things that when we realized that our murder rates in particular, our homicide rates were so horribly high, much higher than other counties in California. And when we realized that other assaults like rape and really horrific things were all increasing, and yet we kept hearing news stories about, oh, we're losing our gang task force with the sheriff's department, or we're losing deputies right and left because they, you know, are going to other agencies. And we thought, well, this is not good, because those two things are not compatible with what I consider to be, you know, a good, safe neighborhood for my, you know, family to be in. And so we asked the Board of Supervisors to do something, and we didn't really get a sense that movement was happening. And so we went back a bit later and said, if we need to do this via the initiative process, tell us, and we will work to do this, and we will gather signatures, and we will try and make this happen with the least possible percentage needed of voters. And then almost immediately after that, we started getting word that they were doing some things. They had found some money for one thing or another, and were beginning to put some money toward Kern County Sheriff's Office. And then we started feeling like, well, are they going to be supportive of a sales tax? Because it doesn't sound like that's anything that people are really interested in.
Certainly a sales tax is often difficult to get passed.
Very, very difficult. And so we knew that from the get-go. And we just really felt like in order for us to move forward, we will have to have all the supervisors say to us, yes, we will verbally, publicly support you in this endeavor. And thus far, I haven't seen that. We believe we need a gang unit. We have a lot of gang. In fact, our district attorney's office has attributed most of the violent crime to gang-related activities. So when the sheriff didn't have the resources for a gang unit, we wanted that reinstated. We believe that our numbers, we have the worst, last 2 years running, we've had the highest homicide rates in the entire state. That is not acceptable. Our substations out in the rural areas, the response times are horrible. And if there's two people on duty, which many times there are only two people on duty, if one gets ill, or if they have one event and a second event occurs, there's nobody to respond, or there's no backup for an hour or more.
Which impacts the safety of the community and the officers.
Exactly. That's just creating a setup for an officer to be injured or killed, and it creates a lot higher threat level for officers going into a situation. It just is a bad setup. And so we feel like that's unacceptable as well. So if we're able to get most of our people in the rural areas drive into Metro Bakersfield to shop, and whether they know it or not, I firmly believe most of them who are shopping for back to school and for, you know, in the big box stores for home improvements, they're already paying the additional 1% sales tax,
right,
but it's benefiting the city of Bakersfield.
And excluding the county. Well, I wish we had more time to talk.
We appreciate you being interested, and thank you so much.
Thanks. Have a great day.
If the women decide to move forward with the tax initiative, they will need to collect 13,000 signatures to qualify for the March 2020 ballot.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. This week, California lawmakers began honing in on a plan that would divert money away from high-speed rail and instead fund transportation projects in major hubs like the Bay Area and Southern California. Los Angeles Times national correspondent Ralph Vardabedian has been covering the bullet train's development. He says this plan is a response to Governor Gavin Newsom's announcement that high-speed rail will only cover the San Joaquin Valley.
What they're talking about doing is completing all of the existing construction from Madera to Wasco, but not extending the construction to Bakersfield to the south and Merced to the north, and not electrifying the line. All of that would save about $5 to $6 billion, which the plan would be to spend on commuter rail on Metrolink and in the Burbank to Anaheim corridor and Caltrain in the San Jose to downtown San Francisco corridor.
Did you hear from any people in the Central Valley about, you know, how, I don't know, their reactions to that, especially because it sounds like if they're not electrifying the line, then it isn't quite the bullet train it might have been promised to be, right?
So it would still be much faster service than you have with the Amtrak system that now serves the Central Valley. And I'm sure there are going to be people who are opposed to any kind of change. But there are going to be people who are not opposed to that. And I'll mention in Kings County, they're trying to exit from their lawsuit against the project specifically because they don't think it's going to be a bullet train anymore, and they see less reason to oppose it for that, because of that. So I think that we're really at the front end of understanding how the Central Valley will feel about this and how other groups and stakeholders across the state will feel about it. It's an early disclosure, and I think there's a lot that we have to understand about it before anybody really can say where it's headed.
The change would be a blow to those hoping for a true high-speed rail. In the meantime, construction is still happening. You can see it along sections of Highway 99. But that work is cutting across farms where some landowners are paying out of pocket to move their crops and irrigation systems. Vardabedian spent time talking to some farmers about how the high-speed rail is impacting the agriculture business.
What that story reported was that a number of farmers had eminent domain actions against them, and they had, in addition to a dispute over the value of their land, some issues with curative costs that they needed to, that they incurred. For example, relocating or drilling new wells, building access roads on their land because their access had changed from the rail alignment, and cleanup issues and various other problems. And those costs weren't being compensated promptly. So in some cases, they were had incurred millions of dollars of costs that they had to take care of and bear, and they were waiting for payment, which was delayed.
And in some cases, I understand some of those farmers were you know, filing lawsuits in order to get that money, right?
Actually, the state had sued the farmers under eminent domain to take their land, and there was a dispute over the additional costs that the farmers were incurring while they were negotiating the value of the land. So I'm not aware of any cases where the farmers turned around and sued the state. It was the state that brought suit against the farmers.
I want to read part of what you wrote in that story. It says many government highway and rail projects end up seizing private land for the greater good, leaving owners angry about the disruption to their lives and the loss of something they worked hard to build. And I want to ask, you know, even when angry, did any of the farmers you spoke to at all agree with the state's mindset that losing their land, you know, was quote unquote for the greater good?
Well, they're all over the map. I mean, you can't say that all the farmers think alike, and I don't know what the predominant or prevailing view is, but I heard farmers, accept the fact that there was some merit to the idea of the bullet train. Most of them feel the execution has not been effective, and so from that basis, they oppose the project. I think they all feel, you know, a sense that the state doesn't value their role in the economy, and what they do doesn't value as much as they should what they do, growing food. But
and getting back to, you know, the cost of what some of these farmers are losing, you mentioned it's millions of dollars, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars for some farmers. For those that you spoke to, I mean, what are the stakes here? Are any of them going to be put out of business because of this?
I haven't heard anybody saying that they're out of business, but the costs are mounting and they're tapping loans to cover those costs while they await a settlement of their case. Some of them are, you know, going to lose enough land that they're going to probably turn around and try to buy additional farmland to compensate for what they lost. I think that in many cases they may lose money. They may see a reduction in their income, at least for the foreseeable future.
And so what did the rail authority say when you brought this issue to them?
The rail authority didn't want to talk about any specific farmer or any specific landowner. They acknowledged that, you know, the process of eminent domain is causing disruption in the valley, and their goal is to minimize the problems.
Okay, and so one of the things I read as well in your piece is that, this issue gets kind of tangled, especially when it comes to like the chain of command and who the farmers talk to, who deals with, you know, the property, and then who ultimately even signs checks to the farmers at the end of that. And then since the story was published, as we mentioned in June, you've also reported that there's been a shakeup in the staff and, you know, in the High Speed Rail Authority. So with that happening, you know, I understand Newsom wants to reduce the amount of consultants, things like that. I mean, do you get a sense that that's going to help sort of expedite the process of farmers getting any compensation?
That's hard to say. From day to day, week to week, and month to month, the problems have persisted. A lot of the required parcels have already been obtained by the state, so all that remains is litigation over the value of the land that was taken. In many cases, there were voluntary agreements and there was no dispute. That should be put on the table as well. Not every piece of land that the authority acquired in the Central Valley resulted in a legal dispute. Many of them did not. But for the ones that did, the problem has been it's a very complicated process, particularly in California. And I think there was a tremendous underestimation by the rail authority about how complex the negotiations would be for these farm land that they were taking. I think they didn't understand how complex the farming operations are in the Central Valley with respect to irrigation, trellis structures, and access roads. So that really complicated the problem, and in many cases they had appraisers who really didn't understand how to appraise complicated agricultural operations. They had land agents who had never dealt with farm issues before. All of that caused some of the problems.
But even noting how complicated that it is, that the farming industry is, and eminent domain dealing with all of that is, Do you think in doing this reporting and talking to various people, does anybody have ideas about how this could be streamlined in the future, or is it going to just, do you think, continue to play out in the complex way that it has to?
Well, the Rail Authority replaced the top land acquisition person, the director of real property, just within the last 2 weeks. That was an employee of WSP, the lead consultant, the consult company that the Rail Authority calls its rail delivery partner. So that position has not been filled as of yet, and there's been other officials who've left, quite a few in fact. There's a new chief financial officer, the co-chief operating officer was suspended. That's a WSP employee for, pending an ethics investigation by the Fair Practices Political Commission. And there have been a number of other departures as well. So there's been a fair amount of turmoil in the employee ranks.
So I guess with that in mind, I mean, that sounds like it might slow things down, if anything, would you say?
It's not going to speed them up for a while anyways. I think the Rail Authority, the chief executive at the Rail Authority, Brian Kelly, wants to rebuild the organization and is taking to heart some of the findings that the state auditor, Elaine Howell, made last October in the audit, in which she raised some concerns about lines of reporting authority and the use of consultants. So Mr. Kelly was ill for much of last year and this year, so he's back now full time, and we're seeing some of the changes that he had envisioned a year ago now playing out.
All right. Well, we have been speaking with Ralph Vardabedian, national correspondent with the LA Times, about his latest reporting on California's high-speed rail trade, how that's affecting farmers in the Central Valley, and we'll keep looking out for more of your work. Ralph, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
And for the weekend, there are numerous historic sites in the valley worthy of an afternoon visit, like China Alley in Hanford. I spoke with Ariane Wing, whose family roots go all the way back to China Alley's beginnings. Wing runs the LT Sioux Company Tea Room with her partner Steve Bannister, and they recently purchased another building in their ongoing effort to revitalize China Alley.
So let's start with a little history of China Alley. Its roots go back to 1877, along with the extension of the Central Pacific Railroad.
Yes, that's when a lot of Chinese who were working on the railroads, and they were also came to this area to do farm work. I mean, their story is really no different from any of the thousands of immigrants that came over to find their, to make their fortunes, to take back home or to start a new life. But a lot of Chinese came over to work on the railroads. And when the railroads were completed, many stayed in this area, continuing to do farm work. And, of course, they purchased land and began building houses and shops, and they had their own very bustling city within a city, their own Chinatown in Hanford.
And your family has a rich history here. Your great-great-grandfather opened a noodle house in the alley in 1883.
Yes, my great-grandfather, Gong Ping Shu, opened his noodle house. It's an upstairs noodle house on China Alley. Originally, when he first came here, he started selling noodles from out of the basement of his house, and it became so successful, he was able to open up his own noodle restaurant and sold his bowl of noodles for 5 cents a bowl.
That eventually evolved into the Imperial Dynasty Restaurant, and that has its own storied history, including an award-winning escargot by your Uncle Richard?
Yes, we had a great ride with Uncle Richard's talents. He learned about a lot of his cooking techniques because he was General George C. Marshall's personal chef and also one of his assistants when Marshall was traveling all over the world, and Uncle Richard went with him, and so he learned techniques from many different chefs and visited many different kitchens. Late 50s, Hanford was starting to grow. Armstrong Rubber was coming in. The Navy Air Base was going in Lemoore. And my family at that time thought it would be a good idea to expand on the restaurants, because we had a Chinese restaurant, the Chinese Pagoda, and maybe we should expand and do something further in China Alley. And my Uncle Richard said that he would come back, because he was in Hong Kong at that time, and if he could do it with his idea and what he wanted to do, which was to serve a sort of a continental cuisine with a Chinese accent. And that's what he did, and we had a great ride with his talent.
And then the Imperial Dynasty closed in 2006, and in 2011, China Alley was listed by the National Trust for Historic Preservation as one of America's most endangered historic places.
They said that our China Alley was so unique for a rural community, Chinatown, because usually it's just one building or a facade, a doorway, but we have 11 buildings on here, and most of them are the original doorways made from the original bricks. That we have a wonderful real life history lesson right here.
And so you recently purchased Imperial Dynasty from your family. Tell us why you did that.
We, my husband Steve and I, we purchased it because, and things just fell into place, so that's why I think sometimes when you push too hard, doors don't open. Because it's an important building, because the Chinese Pagoda and Imperial Dynasty restaurants were housed in one building that was comprised of five original buildings that were part of China Alley. So it was very important for us to make sure that someone in the future did not, or another buyer did not buy it and say, you know, I really just want the land, so I'm going to tear this down. Or some of the really unique architecture inside would be destroyed and altered, or maybe it would just lose the China Alley flavor.
And this isn't your first effort. You founded the L.T. Sioux Company Tea Room. And it was named after the first and oldest Chinese herbalist in the alley, Mr. L.T. Sioux. So do you have plans then for the restaurant?
The L.T. Sioux Tea Room will remain in its little corner on 7th and China Alley and Green Street and China Alley. But what our plans are, I mean, we're still, this escrow just closed like 2.5 weeks ago. So we're right now in the process of talking with our architects and engineers and designers. And what we would like to do is divide up the building back to its original five buildings and have them filled with vibrant businesses that make China Alley a destination point once again.
And why is it so important to preserve places like China Alley?
I think it's important to save these buildings because every building tells a story, especially these in China Alley. It's just history that you can touch it and feel it and be part of it. And it's not reading it from a book, but you can be standing, right where Dr. Sun Yat-sen, the first president of China, was standing, because he was here when he was running for president in 1911.
And describe what China Alley looks like today for listeners who have never been there.
Well, it is an alley. It has 11 buildings on it, and they're all very unique, and some of them have wrought iron doors, and it's colorful. A lot of the buildings are not in use right now, and so we call them our sleeping beauties, and that's what I think China Alley is today.
Well, thank you so much, Ariane.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein,
Monica Velez, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.